Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stern Chats, a podcast that shares the untold stories of the NYU Stern community. I'm Layla Latif, one of the hosts of today's podcast. I'm a full-time second-year MBA student here at Stern. I'm here with my friend and co-host, Uni Amin, who is also a second-year full-time MBA student. We are honored and privileged to be having a conversation today with Dean Raghusundaram. Dean Raghu pursued a bachelor's in economics from the University of Madras in India. He has his MBA from the Indian Institute of Management and a master's and PhD from Cornell University. He joined Stern in 1996 and has taught across the undergraduate, MBA, and executive MBA programs here. He was the inaugural recipient of Stern's Distinguished Teaching Award in 2007. He's been dean here since 2018, and we are so, so excited to have him here. Welcome to Stern Chats, Dean Raghu.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here, and I should say my privilege to be here.
Why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about your MBA journey and what actually prompted you to get an MBA?
First of all, I got my MBA. It's now 42 years ago. 40 years ago I graduated, so it was a different world. At that time, I got my MBA in India, where it was not uncommon. In fact, it was the rule to go for your MBA right after your undergrad. So very few people had work experience, which was actually the model in the US also in the 60s and 70s. It was only then that it started changing. So I was 20 years old when I went for my MBA straight out of my undergrad. And when in my undergrad, I was debating in my own head between going into academia and going into the business world. So I decided to do an MBA first. I really, really, really enjoyed the experience, but ultimately decided that I wanted to try the academic route also, and then I came for my PhD. So I never actually worked after my MBA. I finished my MBA in 84 and started my PhD right away.
Wow. So you had a lot of back-to-back education.
Mm-hmm. Years of it.
Wow. That's, you know, I think for us, at least for me, because I worked for 5 years in between, I had a taste of what having a consistent paycheck felt like. And going back to being a full-time student, it's hard to accept that I don't have an income every month. But had I come straight from undergrad, I think that would have been a bit of an easier transition. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about maybe what you would consider to be the best part of your MBA.
Oh, unambiguously, the people, the network that I made. I don't like using the word network. These are really very, very close friends. Sufficiently close that a group of us, that the study group that was together, the five of us who were together for those 2 years, we've remained in constant touch. And last year, actually the 40th year of our graduation, this is the 40th year of our graduation, we actually took our first holiday as a group of five. And it's absolutely fantastic when you go through that experience with people. This year we had the 40th year reunion of my MBA class. And I think it's the people more than anything else that make the program, the people you study with. But of course, there's lots of other things. There's an enormous amount of learning that takes place. I told you I was straight out of my undergrad. I had the good fortune of being from a family where my dad was the CEO of a company. So we discussed a lot of business aspects and government policy around business, which was highly restrictive in those days and other things. But a number of my classmates came from parents who were government employees. So the language of business itself was a mystery to them. We had a set of amazing professors, some of them full-time academics, some of them practitioners. Many of them very, very good. And so the education was also absolutely transformative. But I think the friendships were really... Worked at Citibank for 6 years before. So I think more than anyone else, I persuaded him to try and to come and do a PhD. And he did one at NYU. But the others remained in the corporate world.
I feel like a lot of our friends are in the MBA program are also going through this realization where it's like, what do I actually want to do next? So of the close friends, I'm really excited to see where they end up. Some people wanted to start with entertainment and ended up in consulting, and then someone started in consulting and will end up somewhere wildly different. And there are a few people that I'm like, I think you're going to end up being at least a professor at some point in your life. You're just so good at teaching there. And a few of them have been like, no, there's no way I would come back to just teach. But I definitely think there are going to be a few of them that are going to come back.
You look at our own school, some of the most amazingly successful classroom teachers we've had have been people who were professionals for 30, 40 years, had very successful careers, and then came back and had even more successful careers as teachers in the last part of their professional lives. Mm-hmm. Roy Smith, Charlie Murphy, many others.
It's great to have them bring that experience back to us and really learn from that piece of it.
Similar to what Uni was saying, so many of us are reflecting on what the transition out of MBA is going to be like for us. So we just began our last semester. Some of us are set up with jobs. We have more clarity. Some of us don't. But either way, I think, at least for me, I almost feel similar to emotions to what I felt when I was about to graduate undergrad, where I feel like I just had so much safety in school. Like, failure only meant failure in a grade, which is a big deal, but it doesn't impact anyone except for you. As we think through it, why don't you, if you're willing, tell us a little bit about maybe a time that you felt like you had failed in the real world. And if you had any experiences where when you were exiting out of your MBA, you viewed things in a certain way, you expected things to go a certain way, and they didn't. And what would you have told your past self today?
Let me begin with the last question. I try not to look back on too many things. I don't always succeed. I think at any given point in time, we make the best decisions based on the information we have at that point. Mm-hmm. There's really very little point in asking, if I had known then what I know today, would I have made a different decision? I didn't know then what I know today.
Yeah.
So I make the best decisions at every point given the information I have. And sometimes it's the right decision, sometimes it's the wrong one. So I try not to look back too much. Mm. I think nobody's been through life without failures. Everyone has their own share of failures on the personal side, on the professional side. Things you wish you had done differently, things you regret having done. But by and large, professionally, you want me to talk about professional failures? Clearly not about my personal life, I hope.
Personal aside, when I fail in school, it's not really a failure because school feels like a safe space. Like, school is set up for you to learn and improve yourself. I think when you move into a work environment, things feel, whether that's the reality for everybody or not, for me, it feels more serious. There's more at stake. So I've had moments in my job where maybe someone else wouldn't think that I failed, but I missed a deadline. By someone's definition and by my own, I felt like I failed.
Yes, I think a large part of it is the standards you set for yourself.
Yeah.
And that you fail in your mind against the standards you've set. That happens to everybody. And I think, you know, at various points in my own life, so for example, the time I decided not to go into the corporate world and come for a PhD, I was 22 years old. I came for my PhD. I was 26 when I finished my PhD and started teaching. And many students in the class were older than me. And I started looking back at what my classmates were doing, my classmates from my MBA days were doing. And they were doing all kinds of interesting things. The world had started. Today, we take globalization for granted. In the 1980s, that process was just beginning. People were beginning to go all around the world with their jobs and other things. And yeah, you do often think about what might have been. And you especially think about it when you are having a tough time. Mm-hmm. PhD job market is brutal in a way that other job markets aren't, in the sense that the reason that most people do a PhD is to get an academic job. Now, not all academic jobs are equal. Some are even more desirable than others. But what is remarkable is how few people who do PhDs actually land academic jobs.
Really?
So it's a very, very small fraction of the number of PhDs that are awarded that actually end up in academic jobs. So I can't give you the actual percentage with any certainty. But in my class of 15 students at Cornell, for example, maybe 4 or 5 got academic jobs. And it seemed to be a pretty standard number. So the majority do not. And then amongst those who get academic jobs, you don't always get the one you want, the location, the department. Like everyone else, I went through a little bit of a rough time on the job market while I was waiting for the offers to come in. And that's when you start wondering whether you've actually made the right decision. You've wasted your life, at least 4 years of your life. And when you're young, that feels like forever.
It does.
Then things clicked. I got a job in what was then one of the most outstanding economics departments in the country, in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Had a terrific 6 years there in my first 6 years and went up for tenure. Now, as you probably know, tenure is like the big prize. It's like making partner in a law firm or something. It's the big prize. So I was very successful in my first career. I was very successful with my research. I wrote a book on optimization and everything went well. I got a large NSF grant and then I got my tenure. And then I look back at those 6 years where all I'd done was work and I realized that actually, I was not terribly happy with what I was doing. And then serendipity played a role. I came to NYU to give a talk in the economics department. I ran into somebody from the business school. I didn't mention anything about my not being happy or anything. And he just said, have you ever thought of visiting the finance department? And I said, I don't know what you guys do in finance. And he says, think about it. I thought it was a polite comment. And then I go back home and I get a call from the finance department actually inviting me to visit. So I came here and I visited for a semester in spring of 95. And halfway through the semester, they made me an offer to stay.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Now, the only problem is I had no academic record in finance. I had like nothing. I was learning the material 1 week ahead of class. And obviously, fear is a very powerful motivator because I never got teaching ratings quite as high, you know, as I did that semester. And then I had the big decision of my life. I'd spent 6 years trying to get tenure. I'd gotten tenure at one of the top departments in economics. And so I resigned my tenure. I started a second career all over again in a different field.
Wow.
Over the next 2 years, in part because I was going through major complications with health problems in my extended family, my parents, my wife, other things, I started having second thoughts on what I'd done. I'd given up a tenure job, everything, and I was trying to publish in a new field. Anyway, against touchwood, second time, also things worked out. I ended up getting tenure again. So when you talk about failures, I don't know whether I'd call these failures, but you know, sometimes I'd have regretted it much more if I hadn't taken those risks. But you often second guess yourself and you often wonder what things could have been otherwise. And then, of course, there are lots of other things that happened over the next 20 years.
So. It's nice to hear because I am about to be 30 and I feel like I've gone through these like second guessing moments at least two or three times. I remember coming out of undergrad and going into workforce at Accenture for a year. And then at the year mark, I was like, what am I doing? And then I found a new team and then, okay, this is good. And then 2-3 years later, again, it's like, what am I doing? And I came to the MBA programs. Okay, I've got this figured out. And now I'm about to end it. I'm like, also, what am I doing? These are questions that just reoccur. And when you're like in that moment, you're like, everybody else has it figured out. And you're the only one rethinking it. And so it's really nice to hear you talk about it candidly of like, you've gone through this multiple times and like things of like luck and just trying to see open to the world of what could potentially happen. And I think that's something I'm trying to channel as like in this last semester, being open to what my classmates are doing, open to what opportunities are available. It's like really rethinking of what do I want? It's hard, especially at the MBA program, because you come in with a pitch. You've written an essay of what you want to do, and it feels like you've committed to it. And when you're by the end of it, it's no, you've also learned and grown, and it's okay to change. And it's really, it's like a difficult emotional thing to go through, saying, what do I want? And that's, it's okay that it morphs over time.
I would say it's not okay to not change. Mm. So let me put it this way. When you were in high school applying to college, you had been exposed to a certain range of subjects and you wrote your college essays on this is what I want to study when I get into college. Mm-hmm. But you don't know what you don't know in the obvious sense. So you come to college, you're exposed to a whole range of other areas, including the areas that you thought you liked at a different level of depth. Mm-hmm. Now you suddenly find out you don't like them anymore and there's something else you like better. So taking advantage of changing circumstances to change your mind, I think a refusal to change your mind is a sign of ossification to me. I think it's not a sign of maturity. Yeah. Our tastes evolve, our conditions evolve, our circumstances evolve all through our life. And you will find yourself often asking this, I'm never going to see 60 again, so forget about being 30. So it is... I still find myself doing it. Yeah. It never stops.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, and not to make this too existential, but I listened to a podcast the other day that was really interesting, and it talked about how often when we make decisions, we just assume that there will be some type of major consequence to the decision. Like either I'm making the right decision or the wrong decision. Like it's very black and white. But often when we make decisions, our life just evolves around that circumstance. And at the end of it all, we could be equally as happy. It doesn't necessarily mean good or bad. For example, before coming to Stern, I worked at an investment management firm in Arlington, Virginia, and I loved it. I loved my life there. I had so many friends. I loved my job, and I was very settled and comfortable. And I think had I decided to stay and not pursue my MBA, I would have been happy. And like my life would have just developed there and perhaps I would have changed jobs eventually or whatever. But now that I'm here, my life is here and this decision feels like it was one of the best decisions I've ever made. But I do think that hindsight is 2020, and it's hard to not look back and say, oh, shoot, perhaps I should have handled things this way or I should have done that. But I think everything in life, I'm one of those people that thinks everything in life happens for a reason.
Yeah, you know, that's why I said I try not to, I try not to look back and have regret about the decisions you made. You always do wonder how things would have turned out differently. But regret is a bad idea because you didn't know then what you know now. And had you not tried it, you might have regretted not trying it. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have said, oh, this opportunity presented myself, if only I'd taken it, and so on. I could have decided to stay in Rochester, you know, continue with my tenured life, and maybe I'd have been just as happy as I've been. I think human beings are capable of being happy almost anywhere and adjusting to almost anything. And we all know that odd person who'll never be happy under any circumstances. But most of us, I think, are good at adjusting to our circumstances and making the best of them. So I like the way you described it.
Pulling on the thread of decision-making, I'm curious about how you make decisions, because I had the first class of managing a high-tech company with the former CEO of KakaoTalk in Korea. And a student during Q&A asked him, how did he decide to take on this job as a CEO, because he had never been a CEO before, and the company was in crisis when he joined. And to my surprise, his answer was, when they're big, big decisions, he doesn't make a pros and cons list. He just basically goes with his gut. I was very fascinated that his decision-making was essentially like a gut check, and there was no pros and cons, versus mine would have been like, let me extensively deep dive. So I'm curious about, like, when you have major life decisions, or even it's like a major career decision of launching a new MBA program or choosing to move universities. How do you make decisions and think about that decision-making process?
So I think most of us think with our gut more often than we'd like to admit. Mm-hmm. Something just feels right sometimes. But when it comes to doing things like launching new programs and other things, those are different decisions. Those we put a great deal of thought each time into what we were doing. So the launching of new programs was done with very specific purposes in mind, right? So one, we've always been a fantastic finance school. We always want to remain that. Mm-hmm. But we were always more than just a great finance school. We had amazing people in every field, from economics, accounting, marketing, information systems, operations, management, strategy. We never highlighted any of it. We were just thought of as a finance school. So part of starting the new programs was to highlight those strengths, give them special emphasis that brought in new companies and others into looking at our students, make those facilities available to everybody, and so on. So we did a lot of work around what are the directions the market is heading in? Do we have the capacity to serve the markets on those fronts? And what are the best ways for us to do it? So those things, a lot of thought went into it.
Okay.
But ultimately, when you're trying something completely new, you have no data to tell you how it's going to succeed or not. All you can do is put a lot of thought into it, and then you decide, yes, this looks like the right thing to do. So you do it. We have built something like 12 new programs over the last 6 years. I wasn't sure that all of them were going to succeed, right? So clearly, you hope that many of them will. You put a lot of thought into it. But we have fantastically talented faculty and administrators who put their hearts and souls into making things work well. And every one of them has worked well. But that luck also plays a role, I think, in that. And
okay.
A lot of effort and thought went into it. But to some extent, when you're making a decision of a model that doesn't exist, you're creating a market that didn't exist. And then you hope that it will catch up.
Most people may probably make those decisions with their gut, and it's hard to say what exactly forces you to do it or wants you to do it. On the program front, it's interesting because NYU has launched so many programs.
But thinking with your gut, I think there is a sense in which your own history plays a role, right? Like, you brought up my switching careers. So my PhD went well. My first career, as I said, went very well, my publications, everything. So at the time that I decided to abandon it and move into finance, I really didn't think I was taking such a big risk, because everything had gone well in life to date, and you just expected that some things are going to continue going. So in a sense, I mean, there was no putting things on either side of the ledger and totaling them up or anything. But he said, great. I'd been at Stern for 3 months under 2 months, because mid-February I was asked whether I wanted to stay. And I was really enjoying finance. I was just learning it on the spot, and I was really enjoying my new colleagues. I loved New York.
Yeah.
And I said, what's not to like? I said, why would I not want to do this?
Yeah.
One of the economists who'd actually written a letter for my tenure wrote to me saying, have you lost your mind? I mean, you just spent 6 years trying to get tenure and you're throwing it all away. But to me, it seemed like a very simple decision at the time. You know, it seemed, it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought. And, you know, so you learn something from that.
But I think there is something really nice about assuming that things will always work out. And I think that our generation has, we have access to so much information and so many options. And just, we're just sometimes overwhelmed by everything at our fingertips that I think it's, I find sometimes I'm evaluating every possible outcome, every possible other option. And I reflect sometimes on my grandparents and my parents' lives. And I think of my dad, for example, when my dad was like 27 or I don't know, in his mid to late 20s, he moved to New York and he started his own business. And sometimes I reflect on that. I'm like, his family, his parents were in India. His extended family was all in India. It's like how much bravery it took on his part to just come here and just start this thing and assume that everything would work out. He did it. And everything did work out. And I'm the product of that. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes without being unrealistic, like obviously we need to be responsible, but I think sometimes you do just have to assume that things will work out.
Yeah.
Because usually, like when I look back at my life, and perhaps this is naive, even the things that I quote unquote thought didn't work out really did end up working out. I didn't get into the college that I wanted to. And then I went to Kenyon, which is a small liberal arts school in the middle of Ohio, go figure. And I ended up there. And that just was life-changing experience for me. So I think there is something to be said about assuming, look, up until now, everything's worked out. You just have to trust the process. And I think all of us have had to do that here with recruiting, and MBA is just trusting the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything in life is right. You control the effort you put in, but ultimately you don't control outcomes. And outcomes are never going to be completely within your control. Luck plays a huge role in our lives, much more than we'd like to admit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's serendipitous opportunity coming your way, like the conversation I had that landed me as a visitor at Stern. It was one conversation with somebody at the next table at lunch. So sometimes things work, and we often don't give luck enough credit for success, and
true,
blame bad luck too often for failure.
That's very true.
And even the decisions that we are looking back on that, oh, I could have gone to this other school or I could have done X instead. The history that you build from like making that decision at that time really like, influences how you will be prepared for the next piece of it. And so sometimes we're like, oh, I wish I had gone on this fork in the road instead. And you would have been a completely different person. And it's easy to romanticize that, but that person is probably also going to be having a crisis at the same moment that you're having a crisis.
And they're probably looking at your life and saying, I wish I'd done what she did.
Yeah, you know, so true. Yeah, that's so true. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about us graduating soon and how I think many of us are coming to terms with the fact that we're graduating soon and we have all these bucket lists of things we want to do, and you know, we're a little nervous and happy and excited, but it's very bittersweet. So can you tell us a little bit about maybe what feelings or experiences you had at the end of your MBA experience and what graduating felt like for you?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, you know, it was, I think every one of the 165 of us in my class, I think, remembers that day with, even today, 40 years later, with considerable sadness. I think it was a marvelous 2 years where, you know, the phrase didn't exist then, this notion of a safe space, but it was a nice cocooned world in which, you know, you initially worried about your grades for the first maybe 2 months, and then you said, screw it, I can't be the best at everything. You just made amazing friends and you had like a wonderful experience. And you were fully conscious of the fact that that part of life was coming to an end, that everybody was going on their own paths. And what we did not anticipate then, which was impossible to anticipate, is how much technology would change and allow us to come back into touch. Because at that time, you know, obviously there was no internet, there was no, this is 1984, a phone call. When I came to the U.S., a 3-minute phone call to India would cost about, like, I can't remember, $6, $7. Mm-hmm. And remember, even in the U.S., incomes have probably quadrupled in that, or at least tripled in this 40-year period. So imagine what $7 then was. And I was living on a student stipend of $700 a month. Mm-hmm. So communicating with even your home was a difficult thing. You never thought you were going to see most of your friends again. I think the advent of the internet just a decade later put us all back in touch through email. And then, of course, the advent of things like WhatsApp and Facebook and others, you know, you get back in touch very, very easily. So in some sense, you're never going to lose that feeling of sadness when you look back. Mm-hmm. But it's so much easier nowadays to remain in touch with people and remain in contact with them than it ever was. Look at my parents' generation. I'm sorry. My parents, your grandparents' generation. They probably lost touch with most of their classmates except the 2-3 that happen to work around them or live around them or anything, right? So
NYU is a global community, and so we are definitely going to be staying in touch across countries, which is crazy to think about. Because I think the comment about like how much it costs to call India, when my parents moved in 2001, I was 8 years old, and I remember these cards that you had to buy from the grocery store, and then you would use them to call, and it would be prepaid. And that is within my memory, but until you brought that up, I hadn't thought about those cards in such a long time. Yeah. And it's insane to think about how much it's changed since the 2000s and living memory.
So to give you an idea in numbers, when I came to the U.S. in 1984, the whole of India had 2.6 million phones. I think the island of Manhattan had more phones than the entire country of India at that point.
Yeah.
And phones were very rare. It took you like 10 years to get a phone connection. So you'd be on a 10-year wait list. It was unthinkable that 20 years later, you'd be able to buy a cell phone and get a connection in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. That's very interesting, like the way that the world has globalized. I was talking to my aunt the other day, and she lives in Delhi and her kids live in the U.S. And she was telling me, she's like, you know, I miss my kids, but I never feel disconnected from my kids. And I thought that was very interesting because she knows like what their schedule is, but she doesn't see them except for like once a year.
I know. So my first 8 years in the U.S., I went back to India once because initially it was much too expensive on a graduate student stipend. And later because in those days, once you got a work permit, until you got your green card, it was dangerous going back because the immigration laws were very different. So in the first 8 years, I went back to India only once. And I used to have 1 3-minute call with my family every month. That was it. So things had changed dramatically in those 8 years, but I almost couldn't recognize some things when I got back.
Yeah.
Today, as with your aunt, my sister calls her son every day. My poor nephew gets called every day by my sister to find out what he's up to and everything.
I'm curious also, you've changed careers, like from economics to finance, you're like constantly learning. And I'm sure as being SD and you have to constantly learn. I guess, what are you excited to learn about in the next year?
I think it's been a constant process. I think academia is very peculiar as an industry, if I could put it that way, that academic leaders start their careers as professors. They're mainly researchers. And then suddenly they're put into administrative positions and then you have to find your feet and figure out how to run a school, for example. I don't think there's another industry that would take somebody with no experience of running anything and then put them in a job and then tell them to do it. But academia, for some reason, this model has succeeded in whatever way, to whatever extent it succeeded. So when I was asked to take over MBA programs now almost 9 years ago in 2015, my initial reaction was, you know, I'm very happy being a professor. You know, it's like a very lovely life. I love my teaching. I love doing my research. Why do I want to do this? Then I actually thought to myself, you know, we spend all our lives complaining about how badly something is run. So somebody is giving you an option to correct it. Like, why not take it? So I took it. And that was quite literally the reason. And my plan was to do it for a year or two and see whether I liked it. But inside the second year, I became the dean of the whole school. And that, again, was a tremendous transformation from being vice dean to being dean. As vice dean, you're in charge of one program, right? Like I was in charge of all the MBA programs, exec MBA, full-time, part-time, everything. But at least you have specific responsibilities, specific criteria. As dean, you suddenly become the face of the school to everybody, to the students, to alumni, to the university, to your fellow deans, to board members. You're now responsible not to the people in the little responsibility that you had, important as it was, it's critical to the school success. But suddenly now you're held responsible for everything. The elevator doesn't work. Who do you write to? Write to the dean complaining about it. Two much more serious issues. And so it's been 6-8 years now of learning almost continuously about things and evolving.
So
going off of that, I'm curious, what would you say is the most rewarding and the most challenging part of being the dean?
I think the most rewarding is, there are many, many things I could cite. One of the most rewarding things is we have, I think, an absolutely fabulous community at Stern that I was always aware of, but from a narrow perspective. You know, the students one teaches, the alumni one comes in contact with, the administrators one comes in contact with, and of course my faculty colleagues whom I knew very well, but I knew only a small subset of them. As dean, you get to know vast numbers of students, alumni, faculty, administrators, donors, people across the university, people across the world. Bringing that community closer, and the success of the school depends on everybody pitching in. And this is a school where everybody's willing to pitch in. And that's, I think, been the happiest moment, seeing what pride everyone takes in the success of the school and how much effort people put into the school success, regarding it as their success. We are not Google. We are not Goldman. We don't measure our success in dollars and cents. So without a clear metric of success, for different groups, success means different things, but everybody puts in 100% of their effort into creating this. This includes the donors and everybody else, our alumni, everyone. And that's really been, I think, the most rewarding part of this, being able to be in touch with so many people who contribute in so many ways. Challenging, almost exactly the same thing, because, you know, as I mean, I was only joking when I said that when the elevators don't run, you write to the dean. No, it actually does happen, but not so often. However, what you find is there is this mistaken notion in some people's minds that the dean is like a CEO. Mm. Universities are consensus-driven organization, right? Like your faculty, for example, have tenure. Administrators have de facto tenure. Everybody is here for a lifetime. You can't change anything unless people want to change. So the co-opting of people into wanting to do things differently and wanting to do things row in the same direction, so to speak, it's always a challenge. It's always a challenge because some people, you know, people are often comfortable with the way things are going and other things. And it's been both the most challenging and the most rewarding part of what we've done. The CEO comparison I only mentioned because CEOs have about, I don't know, thousands of people reporting to them. I report to thousands of people. If things don't go well, students complain to me. If things don't go well, alumni complain to me. If things don't go well, you know, I report to the university, I report to our students, I report to our alumni, I report to our faculty, I report to everybody. Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes I'm at the bottom of the pyramid,
I can't imagine someone emailing the CEO of Goldman to be like, the elevator wasn't working today.
Yeah, that's so true.
But believe me, it does happen here. Like, you know, I get emails about my office is too cold. You know, can you do something about it? You know, not very often, but it happens.
Well, I think your value of community, whether, you know, on either side of the spectrum, it does show in the way that the school is carried out. And I think it shows the role that you have played, because I remember during launch, it was, I think, the first day, and you delivered a speech that many of us having, and none of us really knew each other, but all of us were like, oh my goodness, how did the dean know so much about all of us? And for context, for those listening, if it's prospective students, Dean Raghu delivers this speech every year to the incoming class on their first day of orientation. And the speech is inclusive of welcoming everybody to Stern, but he also recounts a lot of facts and just interesting points about many of the incoming students, far more than you would expect. I really kept thinking the speech would end, and then I was like, wow, I really have a very talented pool of students here who I'm going to school with. But I think that might seem small to you because you do it every year, but I think for the students, many of us still remember that.
It's not small to me. I just love looking at those. It's one of those things you're born with. I just happen to have a good memory. I can't take any credit for it. I didn't do any effort to, like, some people run extremely well. Some people have great hand-eye coordination. I have none. I can't run. I don't have any hand-eye coordination. One thing I do have is a good memory. But mainly, I just love looking at the backgrounds of our students and the incredible variety of strengths they bring to the school. And it's nice to make everyone aware of it. It's nice to make everyone aware of this is like an unbelievably talented group of people that you're with.
Yeah.
And everyone should take pride in it, and everyone does take pride in it.
Yeah, that's so true. That speech really stood out to me.
Thank you. I didn't know anyone ever listens to that speech. Oh,
no, it's really great. It also turns into a conversation starter because I do remember there's a gymnast in our class. And I was after the speech, you remember these facts and you're like, oh, who is this person? And then you're like, oh, you were that person in that speech.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things I deliberately do is not state the gender of the person. You know, when I say it's a gymnast or a athlete or a scuba diver, I try not to use any identifying he or she or any comments like that to leave it to leave it more to guesswork on who this could be.
So for our last question, as we wrap up, we've experienced a lot about Stern in the last 2 years. We're like really immersed in this community. From your perspective, as we leave and graduate, what is like a value or something that you hope that we hold on to or like Stern students continue to embody as we go out into professional worlds? Maybe some of us will become and go back to academics. But what do you hope is like a value that we all take away from our time?
I don't want to answer with one value, but let me say one thing that I would really love if all of you remained engaged with each other, with Stern, with our future generations of students. Whatever organization you join, make it a point to like connect with other Stern people in the organization, create those networks, create those support systems. They are absolutely fantastic. They will serve you a lifetime. You'll make amazing friends. Beyond that, I think, you know, as I said, I don't know whether you remember this, but the point I try to make in that opening welcome comments is everybody here is high on IQ, but this place is not about IQ. It is about the EQ that all of you have, and I hope all of you both have experienced that yourselves, the extraordinary level of compassion, empathy, understanding, friendship that everybody brings to collaboration, that people bring to their work at Stern. That, I think, is the one thing that I would like you all to never lose. And Stern has an amazing culture of treating people with a considerable amount of respect and affection, even if there's tremendous disagreement. Even with this pretty heated disagreement.
Yes.
And that is what I would like to see. We live in a world where polarization is the easiest thing to do, to stop talking to somebody because you don't agree with them and to label them. And of course, the media feeds on this, and social media particularly, but also legacy media. So that's the one characteristic I hope none of you ever lose. What brought you together as a community here, I hope that remains with you always.
That's so nice.
That is nice. The other connection in that speech that I really liked was you took that EQ and tied it to business as a force of good, potentially. And like thinking about how doing well in business can also be doing well for the world and like actually making a change. And it requires that emotional intelligence to do. I really think that was a great way to start the program because I think we sometimes get stuck in our own heads about what we personally want to achieve. And I think that has resonated with me about community in that speech and then also using your individual force and ambition as a way to do great things for the world and the community that you're in and not just for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so, so much, Dean Raghu. I know you're extremely busy and you have a lot of commitment, so taking the time to chat with us means the world.
No, it's really been my pleasure, and I hope I didn't bore the listeners to death.
This was so interesting.
Thank you, Leland. Thank you, Uni.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure seeing both of you, and look forward to seeing you at graduation.
Oh, don't say that.